When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Each episode, I'm talking to performers from film, television and theatre about one significant role in their career. It might not always be the role they're most famous for, but in each one, I'll be trying to find out about the preparation, the excitement, and the sense of nostalgia that goes with any key role in an actor's lifetime. Multi-award-winning actor Jonathan Pryce has been working in theatre, film, and television for more than 5 decades. His work in theatre includes an award-winning Hamlet at the Royal Court in 1980 and as the engineer in Miss Saigon in London and New York. He's appeared in films as eclectic as Evita, Tomorrow Never Dies, Glengarry Glen Ross and The Age of Innocence. In 2019, he earned his first Academy Award nomination for his portrayal of Pope Francis in the film The Two Popes. His television work includes Thomas Wolsey in Wolf Hall, The High Sparrow in Game of Thrones and Prince Philip in the final 2 seasons of The Crown. His breakthrough screen performance was in Terry Gilliam's satirical dystopian black comedy, Brazil. And I was delighted he agreed to talk to me about that experience earlier this year. Okay, welcome to the show this week. And my guest today is the magnificent Jonathan Pryce, or Sir Jonathan Pryce, as we now call him. And we'll be discussing the role of Sam Lowry in the fantastic film, Brazil, Terry Gilliam's film from 1985, which is one of my favorite films. Jonathan, how are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
Good. Yeah. Now, you know, as I say, Brazil is one of my favorite films. I've watched it many, many times. I'm always surprised it doesn't appear on one of those top 10 Christmas film lists that we often see, because it is a Christmas film, isn't it?
Well, there are scenes set at Christmas. It appears in the top 10 or top 50 cult films.
Yeah.
On the lists. Which is not what we set out to. We set out to make a top 10 blockbuster, and unfortunately, we got sidelined into being a cult.
But did you know Terry beforehand? Was he a friend?
No, not really a friend. I'd met him. I knew Michael Palin a bit, but I met Terry at a screening at the National Film Theatre on the South Bank, all-day screening of Bertolucci's 1700s, Part 1 and 2. And I was sat in front of them, him and Michael Palin. And either at the beginning, before the film, or in the middle of the film, Terry tapped me on the shoulder and he said he'd seen me on television the night before in a comedy, a half-hour pilot for a comedy. And he chatted to me a bit, and that was it. And the next thing I knew, he was offering me a role in Time Bandits. Yeah. And I just finished doing Hamlet at the Royal Court for, I think it was £82 a week. And I was absolutely broke, and I was offered two films. I was offered Time Bandits, and I was offered Loophole. I see the puzzled expression on your face there. Loophole. Loophole was a film, a bank robbery, which took place through the sewers, and it got the way into the bank. And it, I got the script, and it attached to it were Albert Finney and Martin Sheen. And I really could not see any merit in this script. And I kept thinking, well, Albert Finney's doing it, Martin Sheen's doing it, must be, you know. So I went to meet the director. He'd been a production manager most of his life, and it's going to be his first time directing. And I wasn't that impressed with him. He's a very nice man. But then I went away thinking, I don't know what the hell it is about this film that, you know, Albert Finney's doing it, Martin Sheen's doing it. And then I got the offer in, and it paid at least twice as much as what Time Bandits was going to pay. And like I said, I was absolutely broke. So I went for Loophole. And, you know, two things happened. Time Bandits went on to become this epic, legendary film without me. Mm-hmm. And Loophole died to death with me.
But I have to check Loophole. Later.
Loophole, no, don't waste your time. But we were filming in Bray Studios, and every morning I'd meet the director. I'd get out of the car and I'd say, how's it going, John? And he'd say, well, you know, John, it's gone really well. Well, what can you expect? We've got Albert, we've got Martin, we've got yourself, we've got Tony, we've got... And I talked to other members of the cast, and I'd say, why are you doing this film? They'd say, well, I heard you were doing it, and I heard Albert Finney was doing it. And this went, we traced the line back all the way to, I even went into Martin Sheen's trailer where he was sitting with his head in his hands. And I said, well, you're doing this film. And he said, well, when I was a young man, I was an usher in the theater in New York, and Albert was doing Martin Luther. And I said, I'd always want to work with him. So this offer came along. Anyway, we traced it all the way back to Albert, who was sitting, he was then in 1982 or something, sitting on £1 million. So that's the reason he was doing it.
And everybody else was there because of him.
Everybody else doing it because of him. Yeah. Oh, anyway, he was a charming man. He was very Albert, and he was delightful. And
didn't do Time Bandits, but then in that sort of Gilliam trilogy, the next one is Brazil, isn't it?
Really? Brazil, yeah. And he used to say whenever we were filming and there was ever a difficult moment, mostly a difficult physical moment, mm-hmm. He would say, this is my revenge. In fact, the whole thing is my revenge for you turning down Time Bandits.
As you're fighting that samurai warrior. Stuff,
yeah. Right? Well, dangling from a wire.
Oh, God.
Usually, you know, at the top of the studio. Or it's trying to act in front of a pyre of burning tires.
Oh, my God. I mean, it's such a massively visual experience. It's sort of... And obviously Terry has become synonymous with this type of filmmaking. But what was... When the script arrived, what was the script like? Does he fill in all the gaps? Does he write all those scenes and descriptions? Well,
the film bears a lot of resemblance to the original script, but... The main difference is that for Terry, the impetus was for writing, it was this man who lived in his dreams. So the vision of Sam Lowry flying and avenging and, you know, fighting for the damsel and fighting for society, that was what Terry's instincts lay there with that side of the film. Mm-hmm. And so... I remember there was a lot of storyboarding came with the script of the images,
right,
and long descriptions of the images. Mm-hmm. And then there was like the real life story, Sam's life. But we started shooting Sam's life experience, the work and the started shooting all those things first. And slowly but surely, Terry was excising lots of the special effects stuff, lots of the flying. So they came down to the minimal part of the story. He got more interested in people.
In the characters,
yeah.
And do I think that came from you? Is there a collaboration there with him where you're... talking about Sam, talking about motivation. Do you have that type of relationship?
I didn't say that, you know, I think, Terry, you should put the camera on me, you know, all the time, watch me acting. No. And I think we talked about the next day's shooting every night. And I was in, I there's very little of the film that I'm not in. And I was in, you know, every day, and it went on for months. But we'd always look at the next day's filming the night before, and if it, not much so much a physical rehearsal, but a reading through the script and rewriting bits, and mostly rewriting and editing, very little adding. Yeah, so the one of the joys of working with Terry then was that he didn't claim to know anything about acting. So once you were employed, he would take care of the visuals and know where to put the camera. And the acting is what you did.
Then who are you, as the actor, who are you, look, are you totally self-sufficient as far as tone, pitch, sort of, you know, because the film treads a very fine line between this dystopian nightmare, but it has great comedic side to it as well, in an absurdist way. And, you know, that can be, that's a very, very, that's a tightrope, isn't it, as far as performance is concerned. Are you the individual keeping an eye on that, or do you have a relationship with him where he can step in and say, let's pull this back, or let's push it a bit further, or what?
I would, it was a bit like show and tell, that I would present, you know, we'd start shooting the scene and he'd look at it. And usually you knew it was working if he laughed, or if he laughed, usually during a take. There were little moments when he said, no, I don't think that's going to work. And I had to say, look, trust me, it will work. But mostly he trusted me, and I, he'd employed, I mean, my job, like I say, I was there every day, and then we'd get the visiting people come, and you'd work with Bob Hoskins for a week or so, and Palin, and they were, it was great because it was a long shoot, as I say, but every time it was enlivened by new blood, until Robert De Niro came.
What happened then?
It's kind of hit the buffers. I feel free to talk about this because I know Terry's talked about it in the past. Is that De Niro found it difficult to play that role and had to be persuaded to play it. Because his character is the kind of the hero who comes in and, you know, he's like the cavalry coming in and saving things.
He's the vigilante, isn't he?
As a plumber, it was quite a sell for Terry to say, you know, because he's used to, then, you know, he was seen as, you know, taxi driver and all those other things, the kind of the, boldly, the bad guy. And this time he was going to be the good guy. And it took a bit of persuading. Two things happened. He took persuading to take the role, but he was instrumental in my being offered the role.
Okay.
Because Terry very much wanted me to do it. I had to do... screen tests to satisfy the producers. And at the time, I just finished playing Martin Luther for the BBC. So I had my hair cut like a medieval monk with a tonsure cut into it. So you're trying to do a screen test as a romantic hero, but you're looking like a medieval monk. And Maggie Gilliam, Terry's wife, who was then a makeup artist, had lots of old Python wigs that she got out of a box. And she tried to dress them on me to make me look good. Anyway, I went through all that humiliation. And this decision still hadn't been made by the producers. Essentially, the main producer, Arnon Milchan. He wanted to meet me. So Terry and I went off to the St. James's Club, to this enormous suite, and we're sitting there talking, and I've got the absolute sense that Armin Milchin does not want to cast me in this role. And it was going quite difficultly. And then I saw down the corridor, I saw Robert De Niro come out of a bedroom. And fucking hell, Robert De Niro's here. And then he comes and joins, he comes into the main room, and he's got his son with him, who's about 8 or 10 or something, maybe. And they say hello, and hello to De Niro, hello to the son. And De Niro points at me and he says to Raphael, his son, he said, "Do you know who this is?" And Raphael looked at me and said, "No." And he said, "This is Mr. Dark." And I'd done a film, Something Wicked This Way Comes, where I played Mr. Dark, the kind of devilish figure. And Raphael looked in shock when he saw me, in horror. And it was like, oh, you know, everything's fine. I'm not really a nasty man. And we continued with the pleasantries for a bit, then off we went. And I felt emboldened by this. And I said to Arnon Milchin, if you'd seen me, I said, "Did you see Something Wicked This Way Comes?" He said, "No." And I said, "Well, if you had seen me, you certainly wouldn't be casting me as Sam Lowry." And he said, "Jonathan, you're sitting in front of me now. I still wouldn't cast you as Sam Lowry." And I thought, oh, fucking hell. And very shortly after that, I made my excuses and I said, I think I should be going. And I left the meeting and I went home, and I completely depressed by this and what had happened and what he said to me and other things he'd said to me. And then the phone rang, and it was Terry. And I said, "Fucking hell, Terry, you know, that's just terrible, terrible. He's not going to offer it me." And he said, no, it's an offer. You're doing it." I said, "What are you talking about?" He said he wouldn't cast me. No, he said, "Bobby was impressed by you. And if Bobby's impressed by you, he's impressed by you."
Wow.
So it was on the strength of De Niro saying, "Hey, he's good. He's good." That I was then offered the part.
Wow. In a scenario like that, how do you look after yourself? I mean, where there's someone else who is...
I don't know. I knew I had the support of Terry.
Mm-hmm.
And you get to feel it's a bit like Red Buses when you're filming for an extended length of time.
Mm-hmm.
That if something doesn't work, there'll be another long in a minute.
Right.
But I didn't. I felt I was just very confident. I was a lot younger, you know, I come from a situation that you know very well, the Liverpool Everyman, where that was my first job, and I was there for, you know, nearly 2 years, and that was my training. And it was, we used to call it Everyman for Himself, the Everyman Theatre. And it was at times on that stage, it was a battleground. You had to fight to let your voice be heard at times, not necessarily just with the audience, but with the other actors. It was very competitive, but in a very, in a fun way. It was a battle all the time.
But it's true at the Everyman. You were the artistic director there as well, weren't you?
I for a short period of time. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that was a tough role, wasn't it? I mean, you had actors there like Julie Walters and Pete Pothersway, Bill Nye. I mean,
I employed those people.
Yeah, but it was a tough role to be in there with them, wasn't it? Must have been.
No, it was for Julie Walters. It was her first job.
Right.
That we auditioned her. And I think Bill Nye, it was his second job. Postlethwaite had turned me down initially to do a play at the Playhouse. And then he came to realize the error of his ways and came to join us at the Everyman. I had a good working relationship with them. I've never wanted to direct again. On the whole, it was No, it was very good. And, you know, Bill, I remember auditioning Bill, and he was sitting on a bench doing, I think he was doing a Pinter. And he started the speech and he went, sorry, can I start again? And you go, yeah, sure. Can I start again? Yeah, sure. And this went on. And I thought, this guy is either the worst actor I've ever seen or a genius. So I took a chance on him. And of course, Bill has that wonderful ability to sound as if it's, he's saying it for the first time.
And then years later in Pirates of the Caribbean, you're acting with him when he, is it true that when you're acting with him on screen, when in real life, he doesn't have all the CGI stuff on. So is he in like some black leotard or something?
Well, it was a gray leotard. It was a gray leotard covered in orange balls and things for the CGI. And they, at that bit of the Pirates of the Caribbean, there wasn't much for me to do. And I was on the point of saying no. And they said, no, we really want you to be in it. And we've written this this scene, especially for you, a really good scene. And that was the scene with Bill. And we could not do it for laughing. I couldn't take it seriously. He couldn't take it seriously. To the point where the writer came on the set and he was really upset because he thought we were taking the piss out of the text. And he was I spent a lot of time. I've written this specially for you and you're not doing it. You're laughing all the time. Anyway, we cut to the premiere of that Pirates of the Caribbean and I'm in Los Angeles for the premiere at Disneyland. It's huge. They'd created this massive outdoor cinema and massive screen, and we're all presented to the audience, and then we go and take our seats. And my son, Gabriel, was studying film in New York at the time, and I asked him to come to LA for the premiere with me. We're sitting there, and two things happened. One, we came to that scene, the whole reason I was there, and they'd cut it, and they hadn't told me. And Gore Verbinski, the director, was sitting a couple of rows behind me. I turned and stared him out. He would not look at me. And this is while Keith Richard had a blanket over his head and had fallen to sleep halfway through. And then the film went up, wore on and on. And I turned to my very film-savvy film studio son and I said, Gabe, what's going on? And he said, Dad, I haven't a fucking clue. This was while Johnny Depp was running up and down the sand endlessly. Anyway, God. That's my part of the guy being. Yeah, but so my one chance with Bill.
Later.
And I never, it was a great time. It was great to direct Postlethwaite and Julie.
That was, you know, it is rep, isn't it? I mean, is it true that you were doing Winnie the Pooh in the day and Lear in the evening sometimes and stuff like that? I mean,
yeah, that was
to get back to that thing with De Niro. That, you know, your training in the British theatre was very much about Alan Dosser was running the Every Man Before You took over. It was very much a community based theatre. You were doing many, many shows, many different characters. The audience were within punching distance slightly, and certainly, you know, the Liverpool audience is very, as I know myself, very idiosyncratic and sort of vocal and supportive, but also in your face slightly. I mean, it is a great training, isn't it?
Oh, it was definitely. I mean, I don't know what would have happened to me if Dosser hadn't come to see my final show at RADA.
Wow. And of course, Liverpool was a very important place for you. I mean, you're North Wales, but you would go to Liverpool as a teenager, wouldn't you, as well?
Yeah, it was not to see theatre. It was to go to the Cavern and to go to, the Everyman Theatre when it was Hope Hall and was a music venue. Mm-hmm. But I'd been in college doing teacher training college in Ormskirk.
Yeah.
And I would go to the yeah, I was an art student originally, and then I went to Ormskirk, and I had to do a subsidiary course, and I was told by friends the easiest course to do that required the least amount of work was the drama course. So I thought that sounds like me. So I signed up for the drama course, and there were only three of us on it. And my tutor was a man called Jerry Dawson, who you must have heard of, who ran Unity Theatre in Liverpool. Mm. And I started working with them. And ironically, we would do our amateur productions. They would take over the Everyman Theatre for a couple of weeks. And we did better business as an amateur company than the Everyman company did. We'd fill the place. But going to see theatre in Liverpool, I initially graduated towards the Playhouse because the reputation of the Everyman worried me. I didn't. It was like experimental theatre, and I thought, well, it's not for me. It's all very anarchic, and I would happily go to the Playhouse where you could go to the box office, you buy a ticket, and you go and sit in a proper seat, and you'd see a proper play.
Traditional.
And eventually, I went to the Everyman and saw plays, and thought, this is the kind of theatre I love. And for me, it was confidence building and boosting. I remember, and I just found it, because I've been going through old boxes with labels called memorabilia on them, and I found a letter that I never posted, but I'd written it during the tech and dress rehearsal of Measure for Measure, which was the first play I did at the Everyman, where I played Elbow the Clown. Mm-hmm. And I hated it. And one particular actor was terrible to me. And he felt it. I was getting in his way all the time. And because I was pushy, even though I was playing a very small role. Actually, this letter started after an early performance. And I was Elbow in the first half, a henchman in the second half, and I stood behind the Duke. And Lucio came to make his case to the Duke, and I stepped forward as the bodyguard and hit him with my truncheon to the ground, knocked him to the ground. And as I stepped back into the shadows, I put my finger to my ear and scratched it. And the audience were just watching me, and they fell about. And this particular actor then got me in the wings and said, "Don't you ever fucking do that when I'm at, you know, all this stuff." And that's when I wrote the letter saying, "This life is not for me. Wow. I hate it. I'm going to do something else. I don't want to be an actor. I don't want to have to deal with this kind of thing." And da 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 da. Anyway, eventually I became the person who would say, "Don't you fucking do that."
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about the Everyman, and it's, you know, I heard you say this because I was one of the last productions in there before they knocked it down and rebuilt it. And we were both talking about the fact that they need to keep that sort of footprint. They need to keep that sort of connection with the audience, because that added to it, it was dangerous because you were right with the audience, but it also had to this frisson that you had every night, which was wonderful. Yeah. But to come back to Brazil, you talk about it being a long shoot. It was a long shoot. And obviously we know that you never tell any drama, TV drama or movie in chronological order. How are you, again, how do you look after yourself? You say that Terry is someone who's letting you get on with it and you know, giving you the space. How are you keeping notes on your chronological performance? Are you making sure that, you know, that your tone is the right thing? Is that all down to you in this performance?
It's, if I say I don't have a working method, mm-hmm. I know other actors who do and would be scrupulous about the arc that the person goes on, but I'm in mostly instinctive, and I began to realize that wasn't my job to preserve the arc of the character. I would rely on the director to It's, you know, we work with the director, and that he would shape a performance. Obviously, you don't go in there thinking, you know, yesterday I was lying on the floor, today I'm going to jump up and down. There aren't those big switches. Mm. But what it's something I find when film is good and it's going well, you do what you do on the day and you react a bit to the day. Not that you, again, you go in, I've had a bad day. Oh, so I'm going to have a bad day. It's whatever happens on the day sometimes. You're not going to vary a lot from the character. But I like to be open to if I have a term for anything, the happy accident, where things happen. Oh, that's interesting. You know, you're playing off somebody else, you're listening to somebody else, and something happens on the day. I you do a lot of voiceovers, but I learned a while ago never to ask for another take, never to ask for a take from me. Because my impression of what it should be like isn't necessarily what they want to hear, or indeed what's coming across, you know. So I never look at the monitor, ever. What I don't want to do is to adjust my performance or shape my performance from what I perceive to be on the screen, because that probably isn't what other people are receiving.
But it's also that thing of like, you don't want to be looking at it externally. You want to be experiencing it internally, don't you?
Yeah. And you can, you know, sometimes if I can't get the blocking right, and they'll say, look, if you come in from here or if you stand here, it's better than, oh, great, I'll do that. Then I'll look at the monitor. But I've had the experience of working with American actors, especially, who sense they have a bit of power, looking at the monitor after every take. And they alter their performance radically from what they perceive to be the truth of their performance. And it's often nowhere near as good.
But also the other thing, the thing that tripped me up sometimes, and this isn't just American actors, it's not, I don't want to get into that UK-US thing, but that I have worked with actors who also have a coach. They will have someone who's not employed by the production or part of the production. It's their person, and it's an acting coach. And that's a very weird, for me, I don't know whether you've ever had that experience. It was a weird dynamic for me to sort of go, well, my acting coach sort of is my director in a way, but if there's another person in that chain, it threw me anyway. Have you ever had that experience?
I've been aware of it, yes, and it doesn't always help because I've even had it on even with directors. Mm-hmm. Well, my experience from early on in theatre was that it was a company, and it was there was a routine that you go into. Well, I don't think we ever had previews at the Everyman. Sometimes we'd open without a dress rehearsal, but whatever happened, the director would come and see a performance. The next day, you'd sit around and you'd get public notes, and you'd all be aware of we're all on the same page, you know, and. More and more directors don't like that public approach to giving notes and rehearsals. And because I think they feel they lose a bit of their power if they open it up to the company. And they lose a bit of the power to manipulate an actor. I mean, I had it in a particular production where the actress I had a really good relationship with on stage, and then one night she was a little further upstage, and I thought, why did she do that? It's not as good as, oh well. And I carried on. Eventually, she was so far upstage, I was having to turn my back to the audience, and I went there and I said, why are you upstage like this? Why are you doing this? And she said, well, the director asked me to.
The director.
The director. And I said, well, I've wasted a week thinking, why are you upstage? And he felt he couldn't share it. And I asked him, would he please give company notes? Mm. You know, he would come in at the beginning of the week, and he preferred to give to go to dressing rooms and give notes individually. And it, I can't.
I think it's essential to have company notes in the sense that all the company can hear the director sort of how he's, you know, how he or she is addressing individuals, and and in a way, then you sort of, you might, you know, we all get take things personally sometimes, that you don't really take it personally. It's about the collective responsibility for the text. And the, as soon as you start getting people in corners, you know, in any profession, regardless, you know, it creates some sort of paranoia and misinformation and Chinese whispers. And it's just not great. I find that really hard.
No. And I know you said you didn't want to talk the American system, but I think it is a feature of the American system, because they, many actors don't, they go straight into film. They don't have a theater experience. They don't necessarily have a theater school experience. And they work with, you know, coaches anyway. Mm. You know, in New York, you have your acting class, and it's about you going and doing monologues and then presenting your monologue the next week for your acting coach. And so it's all part of that system where it is about the individual. And for a lot of actors in film anyway, where you get directors who don't know about acting or how to shape a character, it's a self-preservation thing. Mm-hmm. You know, otherwise they're not going to know what the hell they're doing. Mm-hmm. And they're not going to get any help.
We'll be back with more chat after this.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, you're listening to Who Am I This Time? With me, David Morrissey. Now, back to this week's episode.
But also for you, for one, coming from here to there, going from UK to America or working in American stuff, there is a sense of needing to suddenly look after yourself in a different way, isn't there? There's a way that you're suddenly not in the system. I think I think that's why they like British actors on American television. But there's a sense that coming from, you know, I got a great note once from a DOP who said to me, "Look, make sure," when I was directing, he said to me, "Make sure you direct the show, not the schedule." And I was like, oh, yeah, of course. But there are times as a British actor that part of our tradition is looking after the day. You are aware of the schedule, aren't you? And there's this responsibility that a bit like the clapper loader with Robert De Niro saying, "Hey, mate, we've all got homes to go to." Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's just something in that I sort of like, actually. Sometimes it can get against the grain, but mostly I like it. And also to come back to Brazil, with Terry and Brazil, and I know there's CGI in it, but those sets are real, aren't they? I mean, there's something about, there's a lot there to help you. Those those restaurant scenes, you know, the scenes in your office with Ian Holmes, stuff like that. The choreography that he's doing around it with Ian Richardson. Yeah. That's all there to help you. You've just got to inhabit that, haven't you?
Yeah. Yeah. No, absolutely. And there was, you were surrounded by the visuals all the time. And most of the time they worked for you. You had to get used to thinking, this is a really important dialogue scene. And in the background, there's a pile of burning tires because he wants a smoke effect. And they didn't have little smoke guns, and he burned tires. And everyone would go home with soot up their nostrils. Oh. And or there was an explosion, or there was something. And that was... that was the thing that reminded me most about the Everyman. Is there's something going on in the background.
I mean, the star when the bottle flat is raided by these sort of SAS type guards. I mean, from then on, it sets the tone straight off. So you're sort of in this amazing experience of it. What was it like filming those scenes? Were they? I mean, it does get very, very. Do you take that work home with you, or are you able
You don't. I never take it home.
Well, you must take the exhaustion home. I mean, days are long, aren't they? You must take.
I was young. I was in my 30s. I was in my prime. And we do, minimum 12-hour days.
But you don't live it. You don't live it in your life.
No, you'd have to ask Kate about whether I do, but no,
right.
No, I don't take it. I read, I'm always fascinated. I think sometimes I should get my PR together a bit more about the pain that I suffer for my art.
I've suffered, now it's your turn, sort of stuff.
Yeah. I find that the art is an exploitation and a resolving of my suffering in a way.
Right.
I've worked out, it's for a lot of the time it's been my living, but it's also been my therapy, and it's also been a way of dealing with a lot of issues, and maybe a way to run away from a lot of issues as well. But
I feel that as well, that you can disappear into stuff and sort of, but also play out things that are happening. A bit like you were saying before about responding to the day. For me, whenever I'm working on a script, sometimes I'll be working on it, I'll making notes and stuff. But when I arrive there's a set or the other actor is doing something, I have to be alive to the day, but also I have to be alive to my own self in that day itself.
But if you see, if you looked at any of my scripts over the years, I think scripts when I was, even at drama school, I've still got some scripts from drama school where I've made a few notes. But I don't make a note, and I don't I should, but sometimes I'll go. I won't even. A lot of actors we highlight your role on a page. Mm-hmm. If I highlight my role, it's so I can have a visual image of where my next line comes in.
Of course.
But I don't make any notes. Mm-hmm. No. But
at the end of the, can you let it go at the end of the day? I mean, are you someone who is, if particularly in the theater, sometimes when I'm in the theater, I wake up and I think, oh, how am I going to do it tonight? If my day is full of waiting for that moment in the evening, are you able to sort of inhabit your day totally even when you know you're in the theater in the evening?
Yeah, I think there's always something in the back of your mind that you're going to be somewhere that night. But I quite enjoy I enjoy going into the theater, and I enjoy being with the other, especially being with other people. It's become, because I've been all through pandemic and stuff, I've made a few TV programs and I'm filming now, and the because we're all wearing masks and you don't sit around chatting anymore, the experience is, I'm finding it more and more unsatisfactory.
Yes.
And you don't feel as, there's been odd times on The Crown when you've been called, say the whole family is being called, and you do get a chance to go on the side and have a coffee. And suddenly you find you're laughing, you're swapping stories, you're enjoying the day. Yeah. And but most of the time it's I realize it's miserable without that interaction.
Yeah, but I just found the fact that you couldn't tell whether anyone was smiling at you. You know, you'd walk onto the set or something, and usually you know, you're saying morning or whatever, and you can see people sort of acknowledging you. But with the mask, you sort of nobody's enjoying me.
I've got very good at mime. I'm very big with my gestures now.
Smiling with the eyes, love.
Yeah.
And how are you with something like Brazil, when you went to see the final screening, when you went to, I don't know whether you got a private screening or whatever, what's it like for you to watch? I know you don't watch the monitor when you're working, but what's it like to watch the final product?
You know, I can't remember the first time I saw it, because I was often going into the cutting room and seeing what Terry had put together. I don't remember this. No, I remember going to see other films that I've been in.
And how's that?
And being shocked. And a lot of some films I know I will never see. Mm. There's only one film that I got really emotionally wrapped up in while I was watching it, and that was Carrington.
Yes.
And I knew what was going to happen, mm-hmm. and I died. Mm-hmm. And that was all right, because I'd been there for that. I knew what happened. And then when you know that she is going to shoot herself, I found it unbearable. Yeah. And I just went into the men's room as the credits, and I was sobbing.
Yeah.
And but mostly... No, you react to things in different ways. I remember, I don't think I've ever done this, was I had a screening of the two popes, mm-hmm. Because it was not going to be seen on the screen for a while. It was going to be on Netflix and all that stuff. So I had a screening for friends, and I don't do that very often, but I had seen it, and I was really proud of it. So I was very happy to invite friends to come and see it, but most of the time.
But you say about, you don't make notes and stuff, but do you do research? I mean, you did do research on the two pubs, didn't you? I mean, you went to Buenos Aires and you do research, don't you?
I did the amount of, I've often made this quip that I do research when the film's over, because I have to do all the interviews.
you read the books afterwards.
Yeah, and because the journalist's going to say, "So how did you build this role?" Well, I look back and I'm an instinctive actor, and if the script is good and right. A lot of the research has been done by the writer. Mm, so yes. I don't need, if the script is good, and the script of Two Popes was brilliant, everything was there.
But Charlie, when Pope Francis was elected Pope, you must have looked at the TV and thought, if they make a film of his life and they don't cast me, I'm going to go crazy. Because you look so
I remember thinking if they... I remember being pissed off when the internet was full of these images. And, he wasn't exactly Cary Grant, And I'm thinking, if they offer me that role, I'd be well pissed off. Even my son, Gabriel, sent me a text because the internet was full of it. He said, "Daddy, you're the Pope." But there was a lot of comfort to be gained from that, in that I wasn't a million miles from looking like him. Mm. And also, I remember the last day of filming, that had gone on for months with a brilliant director, Fernando Morales. Mm. And everyone was wonderful. Tony Hopkins was fantastic to work with. Mm-hmm. And my last day of filming, we're in the set of the Sistine Chapel. Talk about not having to, work. There was this...
Not green screen.
Replica that they'd built. And I get up from the behind this screen in the chapel, and I walked diagonally across the room and diagonally across the screen on my way out. And I think that was my last shot, certainly in the Sistine Chapel. And Fernando, who had been with me for months, the director, he said, "Jonathan, it's wonderful. Wonderful. You have embodied everything about this man. Your walk is exactly like the Pope." I didn't have the heart to tell him, but no, Fernando, that's how I walk.
It's my walk.
I've got a dodgy knee, and all my life, even from I remember a teenager, people asking me, "Why are you limping?" I'm not limping. I walk. And sure enough, Pope Francis, he's got a dodgy hip, and he's got this slight roll, and he walks. I remember my mother used to walk like him. Mm-hmm. Their arthritis, a slight roll, just trying to get the legs moving. So I didn't have the heart to tell Fernando that that's how I walk, naturally.
It's an amazing performance. And I think, it's what I love about the film is it doesn't shy away from the big issues because, I think you did say once about when you were in Buenos Aires and you met people like ministers and priests and stuff that Pope Francis, they weren't totally supportive of his history and stuff because of the regime that he'd been a minister in. And, the film doesn't shy away from that at all. And
no, my time with the Pope, I got the best of him because I got him, you saw something of me as the priest, but mostly it was, from becoming Pope onwards. Yeah. And it was important that there was one priest that I did meet in Buenos Aires and talk to. I did do some research there. Yes, I wasn't there on false pretenses taking the money. I can do Pope Francis. I know how he walks. And I was talking to this priest who'd worked under him when he was Archbishop of Buenos Aires. And I said, "What was he like?" And he said that we didn't like him. Really? Because the world had this image of this fantastic guy. And I said, "Really? What?" He said, "In fact, when we saw him on the balcony when he became Pope, we didn't recognize him." I said, "Why? What?" He said, "Because he was smiling."
Wow.
And he was known as the man who never smiled in Buenos Aires. And he was, and that, you just have to know that.
Yeah, that's great.
Why didn't he smile? Now, why is he smiling? Mm. And then I sought out some more video of him when he was being interviewed by his peers, his other bishops, about his possible involvement with the cardinals. And there are two tables. It's on either side of him, and he's sitting at a table, and he looks like grim death. And he's sitting there, and he's drumming his fingers on the table. And again, I thought that told me all this. His physicality told me everything I needed to know what he was thinking. He did not want to be there. He was drumming his fingers, creating his own time. I'm in this time. You can say what you want. You're not going to get to me or through me. And he put this little wall around himself, and he was, obviously denying everything.
Interesting.
And it's interesting. He's been to other parts of Latin America. He's never been back to Buenos Aires yet. And there's two, and possibly two things, because he wasn't that happy there, but also he has strong disagreements with the present regime. Mm-hmm. But he's essentially, I think, a really good man. A really good man.
And is it true that priest that you spoke to in Buenos Aires, who said they didn't like him, didn't he bless you at the end of your time with him? And wasn't that that was quite emotional, wasn't it?
I burst into tears, yeah.
And why?
I burst into tears now, thinking about it.
But you...
I don't know, it was...
Yeah, because your own faith is an interesting, or one's own faith is interesting to talk about. But when you get blessed like that, and sort of blessing your journey, what happened to you at that point?
It was just very, I don't know, I can't explain it. I just had an emotional reaction to it. I don't know. Right. I don't know. It was just. We'd have to have another podcast for why I would find that. Because I'd always thought, you know, when I was growing up, and then I grew up in the Presbyterian church in Wales, and eventually it didn't mean anything to me as a teenager, like a lot of us, and I never went to chapel again. And I used to say to myself, and because I was always, I was afraid. I'm getting old and afraid of death. And I used to say to myself, well, it's all right, but by the time I'm 60, I'll have found religion again and everything will be okay. That'll take care of it. And of course, you get to 60 and you don't. And then you suddenly realize a man in Buenos Aires is a priest who is just has this aura of goodness, and he's got his life sorted, blesses you. And bless my family. That was the other thing that it just felt, oh, fuck, you know.
Yeah.
Maybe I should go to church again or something.
I think it's a really wonderful story about being open to that and sort of embracing it.
Yeah. As I have got older, I'm 75 this year, I've become less afraid of old age. I have to remind myself what age I am. When I'm struggling up a fucking ladder, or my dad was 2 years dead by now. You know, lots of our parents were said to, you know,
I always thought that, you know, my dad died at 54, I think 55. And I always thought, well, if I get that, I'm all right, you know, and I'm beyond that now. And but it was where I gauge my life.
I used to, my maternal grandfather, who was the only grandparent, I never knew my grandparents, but he was one I was mostly aware of. He was the one who survived the longest of any of them. And I was always told that he died when he was 45. And I got past 45, and I said to my auntie Meyer, and I said, you know, it's great, I'm 45 now, and you know, your dad died at 45, and I've got past that, and I feel good. And she said, no, he was 52.
So now you had to get past
that. Oh, fuck. Another 7 years. Oh, panic. So I got past that. Anyway.
There's another thing I just wanted to ask you about, because you sort of changed direction, didn't you, at one point? I mean, you were, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but you were doing the Scottish play on Broadway. And this is what I heard. And then you went to see Patti LuPone in a musical down the road on Broadway, and you thought, I want some of that. And you
No, it wasn't on Broadway.
Was it?
It was
not?
In England. Yeah.
Oh,
I was
right,
doing
okay.
Macbeth in Stratford.
Right.
And either I just finished it or I would, whatever, but Patti LuPone, who I had worked with on Broadway in Accidental Death of an Anarchist.
Yeah.
She was in Les Mis. Mm-hmm. And I had no feelings either way for musicals. I was looking at these people, and they were having this fantastically creative time, full of emotion, full of life. And the audience is, you know, a couple of thousand people there, and they're all completely taken with it. And I was thinking about doing Macbeth at Stratford, where it's the equivalent of beating your head against the fucking wall trying to get, you know, some ring, something out of it. And, you know, at times it was painful, anxiety making on stage. And then I thought, I want to be doing this.
It's given you a whole different sort of path to your career, hasn't it? I mean, I've seen you in, you know, My Fair Lady, and I saw you in Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and stuff like that. You know, it's sort of, it does feel like it's given you something that is so liberating and fun. I mean, really fun. It looks so much fun to do, Jonathan. It's
musicals.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I did Miss Saigon for 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I could have carried on doing it.
Yeah.
Because it's completely sung. I don't know what it is. It's like every night was like music therapy.
Mm.
And it was, you get some real release, you know, it coupled with the fact that it was a big hit show and you've got, again, a couple of thousand people every night.
Yeah.
You know, you weren't having to work to get the audience in. You were there to experience it with them. I had a very different experience when I came to do Oliver. Originally, it was what Cameron had offered me when we opened Miss Saigon. He said, I've got your next role. He said, I want you to do Fagin. And I was like, oh, I don't know if I want to do that. You know, it's a well-trodden road. And then I did a film in Utah with River Phoenix, which culminated in River dying before we'd finished the shoot. And we'd already had the most miserable, horrible time of my professional life trying to make that film with an actress who was an absolute nightmare and made life difficult for everyone. And it was in the middle of that, and I called my agent from Utah, and I said, if Cameron still wants to do Oliver, tell him I'll do it because I don't want to make another film ever again. And then so Cameron went and set it up. And so it's about a year, 18 months later, I'm over my experience in Utah and I want to make more films. And now I'm committed. So, fuck, I've got to do Oliver now.
And it's hard. It's a different, Oliver's hard in the sense that it's, you know, it's a really muscular story, but the Bart's sort of lyrics and stuff, they're quite chirpy and up, aren't they? So it's sort of, it's an odd fit for the text, aren't they?
I met Sam Mendes, who was going to direct it, to talk about it, and he said then that he, like you get a lot of directors when they approach a classic, they say, we want to go back to the original, you know, and we're going to make it dark and we're going to make it. And you go, good luck with that, mate, because you can make it as dark as you want. But any minute now, I'm going to be singing, in this life, one thing counts, in the bank.
Exactly.
I know. And you defeat him. It's a wonderful show, as long as you don't try to make it too dark. And Sam eventually, you know, gave into it. And it was really well produced. Mm. But every night when I'd start this song, Pick a Pocket or Two, and every night I'd go, in this life, one thing counts. And I had this little man on my shoulder whispering in my ear, I can't believe you're doing this. Yeah. I can't believe you're doing this. Yeah. And then I was off prancing out the stage.
Yeah.
But I had a good time. People loved it.
Yeah, well, I think the fact that you took that decision to turn, to go somewhere else, such a brave and also paid off, you know. Just two things before we wrap up. There's two things I would like to ask you. One is about nerves. I mean, do you get nervous?
The time I get most nervous, or did get most nervous, is I hate appearing as myself.
Yes.
And you know, I can sing a musical. I've got out of this in recent years, but singing as myself, you know, if I did a charity cabaret or something, where it's all about being judged.
Yeah.
And if I'm being judged as me, in my head, I can't stand it. If I'm being judged as Fagin, it's Fagin. No, it's Fagin who can't sing. Not me. I can sing.
I mean, I think you have dragged me into a couple of those charity things. I did one with you, and I remember singing with Judi Dench, and I was thinking, what the hell am I doing? I can't sing. Yeah. I can't. It was brilliant, but I've never been so nervous. I have to say, the only person who was more nervous than me was Judi Dench. I mean,
oh, absolutely.
We had to push her on stage, but then, of course, when she got on stage, she was amazing.
Yeah.
And the other thing I just wanted to ask you about is reviews. And how do you read reviews and how do you deal with them? And, you know, what do they play on you in any way? How do you deal with that?
I think I've always read reviews, even though every time I've said, I'm not going to read reviews, especially on stage, you know, in film, it's too late. You can't do anything about it. Some critics you think you want a good review from, others you didn't care what they thought about it. I always wanted to get a good review from Michael Billington,
yeah,
who I liked a lot in The Guardian. And I, there were times when I said I wasn't going to, you know, I told somebody I'm not reading reviews for the, say, Taming of the Shrew or something. And they said, oh, you should, no, you should. Look at The Guardian, it's brilliant, really good. So I thought, oh, okay, okay. And of course, unless they say you're the best thing since sliced bread, yeah, it's never going to be good enough. No. So I was like, why did I read it?
I know.
And then, but you've got to read them all. It's the only way.
I remember doing, I did Much Ado About Nothing in the West End, and I said to everybody, it was Janet McTeer and Mark Rylance, and I told everyone, I'm not going to read reviews. And then just before the second half started on the second night, Jared Kelly came up to me and said, Nicholas de Jong, oh, what an idiot. And I said, yeah, yeah, I'm not reading. He said, no, no, it's fine. He said, but God, what an idiot. And then just as the music was starting, he said, wooden is not a word I would use to describe you. And I was like, and then the curtain went up and I walked out and I was like, thanks, Jared. That's so either, I think you have to, I mean, what I do is I read them and just get through it. In the theatre, I think you have enough time to sort of remint it or be inside it in a way that is yours.
Yeah, yeah.
Also for me, and I mean, I know this sounds like bollocks, but actually when I'm in something which isn't going well or hasn't been well received, I do tend to sort of learn through it. And certainly as a younger actor, I learned much more from those blind alleys I'd gone down, the cul-de-sacs I'd gone down, than I have by, you know, the successes I had as a younger actor. I thought, you know, it was the things that tripped me up that I thought, oh, well, I won't go down that again. I'm not going to do this. This isn't working, or yeah, I'm loving this and they don't like it, but I love it and I'm going to do it,
yeah,
for me.
Yeah.
This is the thing I love and this is the yeah, thing I'm trying to do, you know?
No, it's right. And I wouldn't have used the word wooden about your performance at all.
I've got better than that. But look, Jonathan, it's great talking to you. Thank you so much for making time today. I know it's really, you're very busy. The Brazil is, as I said at the beginning, one of my favorite films. I think it's watching it again over the weekend, there's stuff in it which is so prescient to today, you know, the plastic surgery stuff, the way that we're governed, the sort of crazy bureaucracy that we live, yeah, in, that Kafkaesque nightmare. Yeah. It's a brilliant performance. And and just thank you for today.
All right. Thanks, Dave.
Who Am I This Time? Is a Just Voices and Doolally production. Produced by Simon Lenigan, music by Greg Hatlow. Edited and mixed by Russ Keffert at Audio Egg, and presented by me, David Morrissey.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.